I do not expect to stimulate or create heroism by this fund, he conceded, knowing well that heroic action is impulsive. Impulsive. That was Carnegie's mistake. Carnegie and Darwin were men of science, but they were approaching the problem like poets. Sacrifice, betray, noble, impulsive. Those are judgments of intent, not descriptions of behavior. Carnegie and Darwin were wondering about thoughts and feelings, the why, when they should have been focusing on action, on the cold, hard facts of how. Detectives don't begin a case by worrying about motive, an infinite onion you can peel forever and still end up with nothing. First, pin down what someone did, and maybe then you'll discover why they did it. That's how the ancient Greeks went about it. They put heroes at the center of their theology, which, for all its tales of godly feuds and magical transformations, still stands alone as the most pragmatic of world religions. Instead of bowing down to saints and miracles, the Greeks worshipped problem solvers and hard how-to. They understood the difference between heroism and impulse, and they devised an easy, two-step test for telling them apart. One, would you do it again? Two, and could you? Hercules didn't have one labor, he had 12, plus plenty of mini-labors on the side. Odysseus's to-do list was relentless. He not only came up with a way to win the Trojan War, but he battled his way home afterwards by outsmarting, outfighting, and outrunning typhoons, warriors, enchantresses, a cyclops, the powers of the underworld, and the charms of a sex goddess. Atalanta, one of the Greeks' rare female heroes, showed the boy she could beat up a pair of degenerate centaurs, defeat a legendary wrestler, help Jason recover the Golden Fleece, and hunt down the monstrous Caledonian boar. Perseus, who was skilled in all manner of things, from the craft of the fisherman to the use of the sword, had to brainstorm a plan for cutting off Medusa's head without being turned to stone, then rescue a chained and naked princess from a sea monster. Luckily, one man appeared who could turn all that crazy drama into a hard, clear code of conduct. Plutarch, the great Greek umpire of all things heroic. Plutarch was fascinated by heroism the way nuclear scientists are fascinated by uranium. He saw it as a fantastic natural superfuel, powerful and abundant, and just waiting to be harnessed. Plutarch spent his life analyzing heroes and threw his net wide. He believed even fantasy has its roots in real-life experiences. So he studied true stories and tall tales, Roman history and Greek myths. By the time he was ready to write his epic work, Parallel Lives, he'd heard it all, so you couldn't dazzle him. Even the most beloved heroes got a blasting from Plutarch if they stepped out of line. He reconstructed the lives of Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar. He exposed the shortcomings of Pericles, a brilliant tactician who nonetheless blundered Athens into the Peloponnesian War, and the fatal flaw of Pyrrhus, the fool of hope, who took awful losses whenever his imagination outstripped his might. Plutarch admired Romulus, the wolf-suckled founder of Rome, for remaining true to his humble birth and kind to his 800 mistresses. But he blistered Theseus, who defeated the Minotaur in the labyrinth. Just because you kill monsters and thwart tyrants, you don't get a free pass for sex crimes. The faults committed in the rapes of women admit of no plausible excuse in Theseus, Plutarch scolded. It is to be suspected these things were done out of wantonness and lust. Plutarch did such a remarkable job, Parallel Lives became the handbook for modern history's heroes. It has been like my conscience, Henry IV of France commented, and has whispered in my ear many good suggestions and maxims for my conduct and the government of my affairs. Abraham Lincoln was a devoted reader, as were Teddy Roosevelt, George Patton, and John Quincy Adams. When England was rebuilding after the Great War, the hero's Bible was its guide. Plutarch's Lives built the heroic ideal of the Elizabethan age, C.S. Lewis acknowledged. And what Plutarch taught them is this: heroes care. True heroism, as the ancients understood, isn't about strength or boldness or even courage. It's about compassion. When the Greeks created the heroic ideal, they didn't choose a word that meant dies trying or massacres bad guys. They went with heroes, protector. Heroes aren't perfect. With a god as one parent and a mortal as the other, they're perpetually teetering between two destinies. What tips them toward greatness is a sidekick, a human connection who helps turn the spigot on the power of compassion. Empathy, the Greeks believed, was a source of strength, not softness. The more you recognized yourself in others and connected with their distress, the more endurance, wisdom, cunning, and determination you could tap into. The nearly indestructible Achilles had his loyal friend Patroclus. Odysseus fought his greatest battle with two loyal herdsmen by his side. Even Superman, who wasn't human at all, kept Jimmy Olsen hanging around. Hercules had his twin brother and adoring nephew, and when things were darkest, his best bud Theseus was always there. And of course, brainy boy detective Encyclopedia Brown had two-fisted Sally Kimball. A sidekick is a hero's way of looking into his soul, of drawing strength from his weakest side, not his strongest. He has to remember that even though he shares the blood of a god, he's still human at heart. He's not a titan who will swallow a baby to get out of a jam, or a god who will never die. He has one shot at immortality, and it's in the memories and stories of the grateful and inspired. He has to care so much for what's human, it brings out what's godly. You can hope an impulse or noble nature will spontaneously create those kinds of heroic skills. Or you can follow the lead of the Spartans, who went right to the source, Crete. Sparta's founding father, Lycurgus, traveled to the island to soak up ideas and was so impressed he smuggled a Cretan back with him in disguise, pretending he was a poet while secretly relying on him as Sparta's most influential lawmaker. Sparta's social code is, in a very great measure, a copy of the Cretan, Aristotle points out in Politics, and its defining spirit would become the foundation of both Greek theology and Western democracy, the notion that ordinary citizens should always be ready for extraordinary action. The Greek myths are really the same performance parable, over and over. They're showcases for underdogs using the art of the hero to deal with danger. Need to tame a savage bull? Wait for it to take a drink, then wrestle it down by the horns. Ordered to clean a toxic stable? Flood it. Up against a giant man-bull, a three-headed hellhound, or a lion with an impenetrable pelt? Get behind them and choke them out. These techniques weren't just mythical make-believe. Some were so spot-on, they're still used today in the Greek fighting art of pancration. If you're ever up against a guy who can tear your head off, take a lesson from Odysseus. Odysseus knew a trick or two, Homer notes in the Iliad. He kicked Ajax hard in the back of his knee and toppled him backwards, falling on his chest. Because the way the Greeks looked at it, you have a choice. You can either hope an Irina Bentzel comes to the rescue when your kids are in danger, or you can guarantee it. Daredevils aren't the answer. Spinal rehab wards are full of daredevils. Fearlessness doesn't really help either. When your car breaks down, you don't want the mechanic to say, "I've never done this before, but I'm willing to die trying." What you want to hear is, "Don't worry, this is right up my alley." Heroism isn't some mysterious inner virtue, the Greeks believed. It's a collection of skills that every man and woman can master so that in a pinch, they can become a protector. And for a long time, they were great at it. For centuries, the art of the hero thrived. But as the Greek Empire faded, so did its influence, closing in on itself and disappearing, until the last place the art of the hero remained intact was the wild mountains of Crete, where a band of British Army rejects arrived during World War II for a crash course in wisdom from the past. Chapter 6. Until now, we would say that the Greeks fight like heroes. From now on, we will say that heroes fight like Greeks. Winston Churchill, 1941. Secretly, Hitler was dealing with a problem of his own. He was about to risk everything on Operation Barbarossa, his master plan to conquer the Soviet Union. If he miscalculated, Germany was doomed. But if Hitler played it right and brought the Russian bear to its knees, no power on earth could defy him. Once Germany grabbed control of Russia's oil fields, plus all those Soviet farms, tanks, and Red Army soldiers, the Third Reich would have the biggest, fastest, best-equipped fighting force the world had ever seen. Ponder that, America. Franklin D. Roosevelt would have to gulp hard before coming to Britain's aid. Hitler didn't necessarily intend to invade the United States. He'd be content for the present with all of continental Europe. But if pushed, he could make life in the United States very ugly, very fast. South American friends were standing by. Brazil and Argentina were already pro-fascist, and bringing Mexico on board was just a matter of promising the return of California, New Mexico, and Arizona, and the easing of America's economic boot heel. The Imperial Japanese Navy and German U-boats would strangle American shipping, while Germany's long-range America bombers, still in demo but coming along nicely, could unload a firestorm on Washington, D.C., and make it all the way back to Munich without refueling. But Hitler had to move fast. Russia, as Napoleon learned the hard way, is a mousetrap that opens only briefly each summer before snapping shut on your neck. In 1812, Napoleon marched into Russia with nearly 500,000 soldiers and most of Europe under his command. He came home with 10,000 skeletal survivors and soon lost his own country. Russia is too vast, too cold, and too populated with fighting men to risk the slightest miscalculation. If you're lucky, you have a 4-month window. You have to get in as soon as the snows thaw in early spring and be in control before Rasputitsa, autumn's quagmire season. Once the Rasputitsa rains start falling, Russian roads dissolve into wheel-sucking mud swamps. Bullets didn't defeat Napoleon. He was doomed the moment the mousetrap snapped and his foundering soldiers began dying from frostbite, exhaustion, and starvation. Hitler knew the risks, but liked his odds. Germany had the best army in Europe, while Stalin had done a spectacular job of turning the Red Army into possibly the worst. Stalin was always fretting that any general good enough to defend the country was also good enough to seize it, so he kept executing the best Russian officers and replacing them with lackeys. The troops under their command were often poor peasants who'd never touched a rifle in their lives. Field weapons were scarce and outdated, and the units lucky enough to have functioning artillery lacked enough shells for target practice. So on November 13th, late at night and all alone, Hitler made his decision. It was time to become invincible. It stung him that England was still standing after 4 months of hellacious bombing. But no matter. He could circle back later for the kill. The German armed forces must be prepared, even before the end of the war against England, to overthrow the Soviet Union in a rapid campaign, Hitler told his generals. He chose the name Barbarossa, Red Beard, after the swashbuckling German emperor of the 12th century, who, legend had it, was still asleep in a Bavarian cave, attended by ravens and awaiting the call to restore Germany to its ancestral glory. Barbarossa would be unleashed, Hitler decided, on May the 15th, 1941. By Christmas, swastikas would be flying over London and Moscow. America wouldn't even have a chance to react. The war would be over. It was foolproof. Step number one. Conquer Crete. Mastery of the Eastern Mediterranean was dependent upon Crete, said General Franz Holder, one of Hitler's top strategists. As Greece's largest island, Crete was the perfect staging area for Germany's eastern push. But that left Hitler in a jam, because Mussolini had already gone behind the Führer's back and tried grabbing Greece on his own. If there's any trouble beating the Greeks, Mussolini had boasted, I'll resign from being an Italian. Greece will be ours by December, Mussolini assured Hitler. Consider it a Christmas present. Instead, it turned into a bloodbath. Greek civilians raced into the mountains to join frontline troops, and together they managed to bottle up the Italians in the narrow passes. From across the sea, Crete sent the mountain men of its 5th Division. The Cretans could live off the land, skitter by night across cliff fronts, and kill as easily with a knife as they could with a gun. Instead of steamrolling to victory, the Italians found themselves struggling to hold their ground as Cretan phantoms picked them off from the crags. Dressed in rags, carrying their rifles across their shoulders like shepherd's crooks, joking and cheerful despite the snow and deadly cold, the Cretans were soon spearheading the Greek attack. In one battle, a Cretan regiment was outnumbered 10-1 and still chased back an entire Italian division. Watching this unfold from afar, Hitler was aghast. Attacking Greece through the mountains in the middle of the rainy season? With winter on the way? If mud didn't stop the Italians, just wait for the snow. Right when the Third Reich was awing the world with its might, Hitler fumed, Mussolini's bungling struck a blow at the belief in our invincibility. Christmas came and went, and instead of marching into Athens, the Italians were retreating into Albania. Germany would now have to step in and clean up this mess, if only to save face and avenge the disgrace. Hitler took his time. He wasn't going to repeat Mussolini's mistake and monkey around with the weather. He left the Greeks and Italians snowbound in the mountains through the worst winter in a half century. He didn't even bother trying to stop British troops from coming to Greece's aid. He waited till the weather warmed on April 6, and then he gave Russia a look at its future. When it comes to hundreds of dive bombers at you, and you can't hit back at the swine, by God, it's nerving, dear, one Australian corporal wrote from Greece to his wife after the German invasion. It makes the strongest man feel helpless as a baby. German armored vehicles smashed through the mountain passes, while Luftwaffe planes machine-gunned and carpet-bombed anything that moved. The Greeks dug in courageously, so courageously, in fact, that after one garrison finally ran out of ammunition, the Germans spontaneously stood and saluted. But the long winter's war had left them exhausted. The Greeks were soon forced to surrender, while some 50,000 British Commonwealth troops scrambled aboard ships to escape to Crete, throwing aside their heavy weapons as they had at Dunkirk. In just 24 days, Hitler mopped up Greece and captured Yugoslavia at the same time. Now for the finale, Crete. This would take some finesse. Thanks to Mussolini's bungling, the whole Greek adventure had put Operation Barbarossa behind schedule. But storming straight into Crete could be trouble. If Hitler invaded with a big ground force, he'd tie up troops that were already supposed to be on their way to Russia. But if he went in short-handed, those mountain men could cause him the same headaches they'd just given Mussolini. Hitler assembled his generals and spelled out his dilemma. That's no dilemma, argued General Kurt Student, commander of the elite 11 Air Corps. That's the opportunity of a lifetime. of student's lifetime, at least. Student had grown up poor and clawed his way up through the ranks by taking jobs that were supposed to kill him. He started as a trench fighter in World War I, then was trained to fly and volunteered for dead man's duty as a dogfight pilot over the Russian front. He became a legend for shooting down a notoriously elusive French plane, then bolting a German machine gun to its nose and taking it right back into combat. As one of the few German flyers to survive the war, he was recruited into an underground brotherhood that, in violation of the Treaty of Versailles, was secretly rebuilding the German Air Force. Airborne shock and awe was Germany's greatest weapon, Student was convinced, and he was willing to prove it with his own battered body. Even though he was a 50-year-old senior officer at the start of World War II and never learned to skydive, he personally commanded the invasion of Holland by slicing through shrapnel fire to arrive by seaplane. He was accidentally shot in the forehead by one of his own soldiers, but not even that stopped him. When Hitler was vexed by Kriegt, Student had recovered and was strong enough to step forward with a spectacular solution. Kriegt was Hitler's opportunity to launch the biggest airborne invasion in history. He could awe the world with the Third Reich's newest and most terrifying innovation, a flying army. No military had ever attempted to swarm a major target by dropping in entirely from above, arriving from the clouds without the support of ground troops or sea reinforcements. Germany's big Junkers were powerful enough to tow gliders holding a force of 10 Storm Regiment commandos. Cut the gliders loose, and they're silent. Steer them out of the blinding sunrise, and they're invisible. It was the ultimate sneak attack, a fighting force that could suddenly appear right over your head, anywhere, anytime, without a moment's warning. Hitler heard him out, then said, no. Dangling that many men over the enemy's guns? Far too risky. But they weren't talking about men, Student insisted. They were talking about the Fallschirmjäger, an elite corps of paratroopers known as Hunters from the Sky. You had to be extraordinarily ferocious, tough, ingenious, and athletic to even apply to be a hunter, and even then, two of every three candidates flunked out. To earn the badge of the attacking eagle, you had to run an obstacle course under live fire, jump by night into forests, fire a submachine gun with accuracy while falling through the air at 35 miles per hour, survive for days on only the gear in the 47 pockets of your jumpsuit, and be able to disarm an enemy with your bare hands and use his own weapon against him. The hunters could hit the ground by day or by darkness and come up fighting before a stunned enemy could react. A force of only 80 Fallschirmjäger had forced the surrender of 1,500 Belgian soldiers. Plus, the hunters relied on one of the Nazis' secret weapons. Before jumping, they were issued tablets of pervitine, an early version of crystal meth. Hitler started coming around. Despite his misgivings, he loved the Wagnerian overkill of Student's plan. No clanking tanks or common foot soldiers, just wave after wave of Germany's fiercest commandos raining down from the sky like apocalyptic demons. It was more than warfare. It was biblical doom. Hitler found the theatrics so tantalizing, he insisted they feature Germany's greatest star, Max Schmeling, the world heavyweight boxing champion who'd knocked out Joe Louis. Having a celebrity like Max Schmeling leap out of a plane behind enemy lines was an astonishing command, but it neatly served two purposes. Privately, it settled a personal grudge between the Führer and the famous fighter, who refused to join the Nazi party and, it was rumored, had saved the lives of his Jewish trainer's two sons by hiding them in his hotel room and smuggling them to safety in the United States. Publicly, it added another chilling image to the Nazis' gallery of terror. A photo of the muscular German colossus as his big boots thumped down on the dust of Crete would send an unmistakable message. Our giants are coming, and they can't be stopped. for a Third Reich so enraptured by Death's Head skulls, blood-red flags, and the raw rape symbolism of the swastika, with its two interlocked bodies representing, as Hitler put it, the struggle for the victory of the Aryan man. The sight of Germany's two-fisted champion striding across the ancient world was irresistible. Crete was the birthplace of the modern world, the origin of every great achievement in civilization, and Hitler would show he could snatch it up in a matter of hours. Besides, wasn't it time the Nazis were greeted as heroes for a change? German troops weren't really invading Crete, General Student pointed out. They were liberating it. The Cretan islanders were so sick of being ruled by the Greek king, Hitler would become their idol as soon as they realized the arrival of the Germans meant the end of the monarchy. In fact, Student had it on good authority that a super-secret underground of Cretan rebels was eager to greet its new German friends and had already worked out a passcode. Top dog, the Germans were supposed to call out. Big buck, the Cretan underground would reply. And the celebration would begin. Hitler relented. He dubbed Student's plan Operation Mercury, after the Roman god of thievery and lightning speed, and set the go date for May the 20th. It took 24 days to capture the mainland. Hitler would allow 24 hours for Crete. One day. Then it was on to Russia. May the 20th, 1941, dawned beautifully. So Colonel Howard Kippenberger of the New Zealand 10th Brigade grabbed a plate of porridge and went outside to enjoy the sun rising over the Aegean. Weird, he thought as he settled in under a plane tree. What happened to the sun? A minute earlier, there wasn't a cloud in the sky, but now, all of a sudden, he's sitting in shadows. Wait! He jerked his head up, stunned. Overhead, German gliders were silently soaring in. So many, they darkened the sky. Kippenberger grabbed for his rifle, but he'd left it in his room. Kippenberger had never seen anything like it. There had to be hundreds of commandos inside those gliders. Hard behind was a sea of transport planes, with wave after wave of elite Fallschirmjäger paratroopers pouring out the jump doors. "Stand to your arms!" Kippenberger shouted, praying that not too many of his troops were splashing naked in the sea at that moment. By the time he got his rifle, Germans were on the ground and scrambling for position. Bullets splintered the olive trees. Snipers had already nested, with sightlines toward the little house serving as Kippenberger's headquarters. Above, the sky was so hectic with men and machines that one stunned soldier felt he was witnessing the Martian occupation of Earth from H.G. Wells's War of the Worlds. Many of Kippenberger's men were mechanics and drivers, not frontline soldiers. They backed up, firing desperately and uncertainly, while Kippenberger hurried to the top of a hill to get a clear view of how much trouble they were in. Lots, it turned out. When it came to troops, Crete was an island of castaways. Nearly every soldier there was a refugee from the fighting on the Greek mainland, a hodgepodge of Australians, New Zealanders, Brits, and Greeks. As ordered, they chucked their heavy weapons when they were ferried to Crete, where they'd hunkered down to await one of two things, either massive reinforcement or a speedy retreat. Anything else would be a massacre. One battalion didn't even have boots. Their ship had been torpedoed on the way to Crete, so they dumped their rifles and shoes to swim for it. "Forces at my disposal are totally inadequate to meet the attack envisaged," concluded Major General Bernard Freiburg of New Zealand after he arrived on Crete to take command. Was Freiburg seriously expected to defend one of the most strategically important islands in the Mediterranean with, as he put it, "gunners who had lost their guns, sappers who had lost their tools, and RSAC drivers who had lost their cars?" He wasn't sure what Hitler had in mind, but if it was even a fraction of the firepower unleashed on the mainland, the Brits were doomed. Coming from a wild man like Freiburg, gloom like that had to be taken seriously. Churchill loved Freiburg, and had nicknamed him the Salamander, after the myth that salamanders are created by fire. Freyberg had left New Zealand as a young man to join Pancho Villa's rebels in Mexico, so hungry for action that he travelled across the globe to plunge into a war he only dimly comprehended, in a language he didn't speak. When World War I broke out, young Freyberg jumped into a series of swimming races in Los Angeles and won enough prize money to pay for passage to England. He enlisted and quickly made his mark by stripping naked for a suicide mission. To distract Turkish forces during the invasion at Gallipoli, he smeared his body with grease, dived off of a troop ship, and swam 2 miles through the bone-chilling Gulf of Saros to light diversionary flares on a beach behind enemy lines. He became England's youngest general at 28, and was wounded so many times that one of Churchill's party tricks was to get Freyberg to peel off his shirt so other guests could count his 27 battle scars. But even for the Salamander, Crete was too much, or rather, too little. Freyberg should have at least had some local troops who knew the terrain, but he'd been robbed of even that slim advantage. The Cretan division was still stranded back on the mainland. The drug-enhanced hunters were on the ground and moving fast, wriggling free of their harnesses and breaking open the weapon crates, thumping down nearby. In minutes, the full Schirmjäger were better equipped than the British. Besides motorcycles and surgical equipment, the crates also had specially designed field guns, powerful enough to blow a hole through a tank. Quickly, the Germans grouped into attack formation and began advancing, cutting telephone lines to British headquarters as they moved. But hold on a moment! Up on his hill, Kippenberger noticed one German squad was going the wrong way. Instead of advancing, they were edging backwards. Suddenly they were running, falling, shouting, and being chased by the 8th Greek Regiment. Kippenberger couldn't believe his eyes. When he'd first spotted the 8th Greeks, he cringed. They were so dangerously exposed, he thought. It was murder to leave such troops in such a position. But now look at them. Outgunned and outmanned, they improvised from a stand-your-ground defense to a hit-and-run guerrilla offense, flipping the element of surprise back to their favor. The Greeks had only vintage rifles and a handful of shells, but that's all they needed. As soon as their fire drove the Germans back, they raced to the dying paratroopers, stripped away their weapons, and charged on. And the 8th wasn't outnumbered for long. A mob of villagers armed with sickles and axes ran to join them. One farmer fashioned a bayonet by lashing a knife to the end of his shotgun. Another old Cretan used his cane to beat to death 2 paratroopers who'd gotten snarled in their harnesses in his back garden. A priest named Father Stylianos Franciscakis rang the church bell to summon his parishioners, then grabbed his uncle's hunting rifle and led his congregation into combat. A teenage boy followed him, dragging an old Turkish sword that was so long it scraped along the ground. "My mother sent me," the boy told Father Franciscakis. A monk headed into the fray with a rifle in his hand and a hand axe in his belt. Later, the same hatchet-wielding holy man reappeared with a German submachine gun, presumably after killing the German who'd carried it. A bewildered young British officer named Michael Forrester found himself at the head of a weird counterattack, as he called it. Forrester had gotten separated from his unit and stumbled across a leaderless band of Greek soldiers under fire from a German platoon. With their backs against the sea, the Greeks were trapped. Forrester decided to take command, even though just about the only Greek word he knew was aerea. Charge! Maybe he could toot commands on a tin whistle. Sure, why not? Forrester hurriedly taught his new force a signal code. 1 tweet to stand by, 2 to move. And then fixed his bayonet for a do-or-die attempt to break through the German net. I decided that the time had come for action and alerted my force with my whistle, Forrester would later say. We had not gone very far, before I realized that we had been substantially reinforced by a considerable number of the inhabitants of Crete, men and women, armed with old shotguns, garden tools, sticks, broom handles, some with kitchen knives strapped on to the end of them. With Forrester shrilling away on his whistle, the mob charged. The Germans dropped their weapons and put up their hands. Back at his command post in Athens, General Kurt Student was getting minute-by-minute updates by radio. He unsnapped his holster. "I waited with my pistol continuously by my side," he said, "ready to use it on myself if the worst came to the worst." Chapter 7 France fell in 5 days. Why is Crete still resisting? Adolf Hitler, in a message to General Kurt Student. Too late. General Student was discovering that on Crete, heroes aren't an accident. For more than 1,000 years, in both fact and fable, the island has been a battleground between tyrants and rebels, gods and monsters. Crete was the birthplace of Zeus, the home of the Minotaur, the launch site of Daedalus and Icarus, and the homeland of canny backwoodsmen who, for generations, refused to bow to Turkish or Venetian warlords. From those myths and struggles emerged not only the heroic ideal, but the means to achieve it. A folk science of mind and body that's ancient, alive, and very teachable. "They are good archers, every one with his bow and arrows, a sword and dagger, with long hair and boots that reach up to their groin, and a shirt of mail," noted a British trader in the 1500s, who was just as intimidated by the festivals as the fighting. "They would drink wine out of all measure." Jack Smith Hughes learned firsthand about the Cretan art of the hero during the German invasion, and it kept him breathing long after he should have been dead. Jack had pink cheeks and a bit of a belly. No surprise, since his greatest contribution for much of the war was running a field bakery and supplying bread to the front lines. Jack didn't want to lose his supply trucks to enemy ambush, so he decided to reroute by water. And it was then, while dispatching a boatload of food to troops farther up the coast, that he found himself standing next to the Allied commander. General Freiburg had gotten word that an Australian detachment was under fire without a working radio, so he'd sent a messenger by boat with orders to retreat. Instead of pivoting to other emergencies, Freiburg began pacing the waterfront. It was as if the fighting that raged elsewhere across the island had melted away, and the only thing that mattered was one small pocket of beleaguered Australians. The baker wasn't sure what to do and found himself pacing the jetty alongside his brooding commander. Was Freiburg cracking under the pressure? He was famous for keeping his cool during Gallipoli and the Somme, two of the most horrific bloodbaths of World War I. But now that he was on the verge of a stunning victory, he looked distracted and defeated. "We're about to defeat Hitler's best fighters," Jack thought. "Aren't we?" Freiburg's underdog troops had rallied magnificently once the shock of the air attack had worn off. Many of the New Zealanders were country boys, and their confidence grew as they realized this was their kind of fight. A hunter dropping from the sky wasn't much different from a wild boar blasting from the bush back home in Kaikoura. So Kippenberger's petrol company quickly adjusted their fire to the paratrooper's 4 meters per second drop speed, aiming for their feet to make kill shots to the chest. So sharp was their marksmanship, one Fulsheim Jäger battalion was convinced it had dropped into a den of super soldiers. It was particularly noticeable that a very large proportion of our casualties had been shot in the head, a Fulsheim Jäger sergeant major would report. The controlled fire and discipline of the enemy led us to believe that we were up against a specialist force of picked snipers. Two of the New Zealanders held down the entire western side of a hill on their own for 6 days. Springtime on Crete is hot and dry, and German uniforms were wool, so it wasn't long before the Cretan shepherds faded from the fray, settling in behind stone walls with sight lines on cool springs.
"The only well where we could get water," paratrooper Sebastian Krug would recall, "was being shot at all the time."
The New Zealanders caught onto the idea and set ambushes of their own, lying in wait near the paratroopers' supply boxes. From the olive groves, the same cry began to ring out over and over.
"Got the bastard!"
This isn't warfare. This is ritual suicide. Long past midnight, General Student was still at a table in his command room, stubbing cigarettes into an overflowing ashtray as he read the battle dispatches. His Luger remained ready by his hand. Because of him, the Third Reich's finest fighters were being slaughtered by shepherds and pig hunters. More than half of Student's 10,000-man invasion force was dead, wounded, or captured. Many of the rest were lost or hiding for their lives. All three Blücher brothers, from the fabled fighting family whose patriarch led the Prussian army against Napoleon, were gone. Max Schmeling's photo op nearly did him in. He'd parachuted through machine gun fire, passed out after landing hard and injuring his back, then hid till nightfall and eventually crawled back to his unit. If there was a way out of this fiasco, Student didn't see it. Then something caught his eye. Amid the bad news, one thing should have been worse. Why hadn't the Brits blown up Malamé, the small airfield on Crete's northwest coast? That's the first thing Student would have done if he were defending Crete. He'd have packed Malamé with dynamite and blasted it into a moon crater the second he saw a parachute pop open. Crete is basically a rectangle, with two good-sized airfields along its northern coast. Master the airfields, and you master the island. The Brits could get in and out by sea, thanks to its Royal Navy, but the Germans weren't as strong in the water. With no place to land their planes, the hunters would be stranded. The airfield was well defended at Heraklion, in the center, but Malamé, in the west, was a different story. That's where Student had thrown his biggest punch, swarming Malamé with 50 gliders full of Storm Regiment commandos and three companies of Fallschirm Jäger. It was a gruesome operation. Both gliders and paratroopers dropped right into a hail of burning flak that tore through flesh and parachute silk. By the time the survivors hit the ground, the trees were littered with their comrades' bodies.
"All over the place you could see dead and wounded Fallschirmjäger, some still hanging from their parachutes."
A Fallschirmjäger survivor named Helmut Wenzel later jotted in his diary.
"There had been a lot of bloodshed, and you could hear the crying and shouting of the wounded and dying."
That's when the hunters showed what they were made of, gathering and advancing through that nightmare of moaning men. Attacking only with handguns and grenades, they managed to grab their heavy weapons from the drop boxes. Wenzel, with two severe wounds and just a pistol, staggered to his feet to join them. One force headed for high ground, overlooking the airfield, while the other charged the anti-aircraft battery. By late afternoon, the Germans had knocked out the big guns and captured the hill, but at a brutal cost. Their officers were dead. Their ammo was low, and only 57 men were still alive. Most were so hurt and weak, they could barely stand. They prepared themselves to die. They had no hope against the Allied counterattack that was about to come storming up the hill. Except, it never came. The Allied commanders on Crete were so braced for defeat, they didn't realize they'd already won. Without Malamé, the Germans had no lifeline back to the mainland. It was only a matter of days, hours even, until the invaders ran out of food and bullets. But with phone lines down and radios failing, with Allied officers in the rear out of contact with fighters on the front, assumptions took over for action. When the colonel defending Malamé didn't see the reinforcements he requested, he assumed headquarters wanted him to pull back. When headquarters learned he was pulling back, it assumed Malamé was a lost cause and diverted the reinforcements. You don't beat Kurt Student by giving him a second chance. Before dawn of day two, German troop planes were taking to the sky, one after the other, roaring toward Mallarmé. Student had decided to stake everything on one card. He committed the 5th Mountain Division and the last of his Fulschim Jäger reserves to a final all-or-nothing assault on the airfield. Only a few New Zealand troops were still within firing range of the eastern end of the runway when they heard the first Junker approach. They blazed away, riddling the plane with bullets as it skidded down just long enough to drop off 40 Mountain Division soldiers and then disappeared back over the Mediterranean. The New Zealanders shifted their aim toward the Germans sprinting for cover, gunning many of them down before they got a few steps across the runway. But a few reached the trenches and returned fire, creating cover for the next Junkers screeching down. More Germans tumbled off, scrambling into the gullies as a third plane approached, then a fourth. The New Zealanders were stunned. 10 minutes ago, they were in a nice holding position against an exhausted enemy, waiting for orders to either mop up or march off. Now, suddenly, they were burning through the last of their ammunition, shooting helplessly against an enemy that was doubling, tripling by the minute. Time was still on their side, but not for long. They had to attack immediately and put an end to the job they should have finished yesterday. They had to storm the hill before the Germans landed any more troops and fortified their hold on the airfield. This was their chance. Bayonets were fixed, grenades were handed around, and then the order came from the rear, stand down. Back at headquarters, Freiburg was still convinced that the real invasion was coming by sea. All these planes and paratroopers? Just a feint to lure Allied troops into the hills and leave the coast undefended. Absolutely correct, agreed Brigadier James Hargest. Like Freiburg, the beefy old brigadier was a survivor of the Great War and thought he was still fighting it. Hargest spent the boat trip over to Crete reading War and Peace, and from the old Russians he took his cue. In war, Hargest preached, steadiness and endurance are more important than any amount of strategic flair. The key to Crete, he urged Freiburg, was caution and the coastline. Which could explain why, days later and long after the golden opportunity was gone, Freiburg was walking the waterfront alongside a bewildered young bakery manager, watching for an enemy armada that would never appear. They were brave men, but no longer bold, lamented Anthony Beaver, the British military historian who wrote the definitive account of the invasion. The Battle of Crete, a revolutionary development in warfare, was to be a contest in which fast reactions, clear thinking, and ruthless decisions counted most. Freiburg still had his boots sunk in the mud of the Somme, while Student, so feverishly inventive that he could use German parts to rebuild a shot-down French plane and fly it straight back into action, had no interest in refighting a war his country had already lost. But still, there was a moment when the past might have prevailed, when trench-style tactics could have choked the Germans into submission. And that's the moment when Freiburg flinched. A single platoon, even a single Bren gun left in place on the airfield, Beaver concludes, could have swung the course of the whole battle. As waves of German troops fanned out from Mallarmé, Jack Smith Hughes was soon scrambling to stay one step ahead of his friends and two steps ahead of the enemy. The Royal Navy couldn't risk many ships on yet another Dunkirk, so anyone who didn't reach southern Crete quickly wasn't leaving. "Orders are every man for himself," a sergeant shouted. Thousands of Allied soldiers scrambled frantically up and over the White Mountains, clinging to a crumbling trail that skirted a near-vertical wall of the road on one side and a dropfall of hundreds and hundreds of feet on the other. As British infantryman Edward Frederick Telling would recall, all with no lights. Jack Smith Hughes was footsore and starving when he limped into the port as Stakya, and surprised when he was told he didn't need to line up right away. More evacuations were planned for the next day, an officer promised, before climbing into a skiff himself. The next morning, Jack Smith Hughes was staring into the barrel of a German rifle. Along with thousands of other Allied troops abandoned on Crete, Jack was forced at gunpoint to hobble back over the mountains he just crossed. When the prison gate closed behind him, Jack knew he had two choices. He could escape and get shot, or stay behind the wires and waste away. Already, men all around him were dying of wounds and disease. Well, better a quick bullet than a slow death. One night, Jack followed a Cretan prisoner through the wire, and together they escaped into the hills. Before sentries could track them, they were grabbed by villagers and pulled out of sight. Jack was hidden and fed, nursed back to health on a Cretan villager's diet of wild greens, dark bread so hard it had to be soaked in wine before biting, and fasolakia me katsiki, beans simmered with goat. Jack was still too weak to hide out in the mountains, so his new friends came up with a plan B. Turn the pudgy blonde Brit into a Cretan. The villagers renamed him Yarni and drilled him on the peculiarities of their dialect. Like the word for adult, on Crete, a grown-up is known as a dromaeos, or runner. To be considered a full Cretan, you had to be strong and resourceful enough to run to someone's aid. Until then, young Cretans are just apodromus, not quite a runner. And the ritual passage into adulthood was celebrated with the festival of Dromaea, the running. Gradually, Jack's strength returned. By his standards, at least. Keeping pace with the geriatric Dromaeos was a different story. Jack was taken under the wing of a bald and blue-eyed Cretan in his 50s, who was so buoyantly unkillable that the Brits would codename him Beowulf. Beowulf was once shot between the lungs, but suffered no visible ill effects. Beowulf guided Jack to fresh hiding places, keeping him a jump ahead of German search parties and subjecting him to the ego-crushing experience of following an old Cretan into the mountains. Instead of struggling, they seemed to fall upward, bouncing from rock to rock for hours with an odd, effortless-looking elasticity. It wasn't just the men. Cretan women could likewise carry heftier packs, cover longer distances, navigate through snow and dark, and thrive on a diet plucked from the ground as they passed. Strength didn't explain it. It was as if the Cretans were drawing on something else, a martial art of energy mastery. Under any kind of pressure, physical or mental, they seemed to become more pliable. Near Jack's hiding place, for instance, a teenage boy who'd blown up a German plane by sticking a burning rag into the gas tank turned himself in when the Germans threatened to murder his family. George Vernadakis was beaten and starved, then dragged naked into the village square to be executed. Dazed and weak, he had a last request. Could he please wet his lips with a glass of wine and sing a farewell song? The wine was produced, and George's hands were unchained. He drank it down and took off, darting naked from lane to lane through the village. George not only got away, but kept on fighting. The next time his family saw him, he was in an Air Force uniform. After 5 months in hiding, Jack was introduced to George Sikundakis, a young shepherd with frenzied hair and impish eyes. George thought he knew a way to get Jack off the island and to safety in Egypt. It was risky, but if Jack was willing to trust him, they could give it a try. Jack figured they'd slink invisibly through the backcountry and rendezvous with some patriotic fishermen in a hidden cove. Instead, he found himself the main attraction of a bizarre parade. The two men were escorted by 15 armed shepherds, and every time they passed through a village, more eager rebels rushed out to join them.
Wherever we went, the villagers, seeing us carrying arms, almost exploded with joy,
George would later recall.
Everyone thought something important was afoot and prepared to take up their guns and follow us. We calmed them down and told them they would be warned in time when the moment came.
Despite nearly inciting insurrection, Jack and his gang managed to dodge German patrols and make it to the Preveli Monastery, a stone sanctuary on a cliff tended by monks since the Middle Ages. A few weeks earlier, the monks were in the middle of High Mass when a British submarine commander, with a pirate's gold hoop in his ear, burst through the door. He'd been prowling the coast for stranded soldiers, and when he spotted an SOS beacon flashing from a bluff near the monastery, he came ashore personally to check it out. Word soon spread along the Cretan Whisper network. Any Brit on the run who could make it to Preveli fast had a chance of escape. A few nights later, Jack Smith Hughes was being paddled out toward the sub in a rubber raft. Watching from the beach were George Sikandakis and other descendants of the world's first heroes waiting for Jack, and any other Brits who dared to join them, to return. Chapter 8. We were totally amateurish, totally 100% amateurish, and it couldn't have been otherwise. Basil Davidson, one of Churchill's original dirty tricksters. Wait, George is still alive? Chris White hung up the phone, stunned. It was the summer of 2004, and Chris had just gotten a call from a friend whose son was a journalist in Greece. Her son had gone to Crete in search of World War II survivors, Chris's friend said. And there, among the backcountry villages, he came across the old resistance runner himself, still roaming the high mountain ranges. Good Lord, how was that even possible? The odds of survival in the Dirty Trick Squad was appalling. Half of the recruits were captured or killed in the first year alone. And of all their assignments, none was riskier than George Sikandakis's. Other resistance fighters spent a good deal of their time in hiding, but runners lived in the red zone, zigzagging through enemy patrols while carrying documents that guaranteed a death sentence if discovered. Runners were an especially high-value target for the Gestapo, who knew they rarely carried weapons and could lead them directly to nearly every guerrilla hideout. Two other shepherds from George's Valley became runners along with him. They were soon captured, tortured, and shot.
The job of a wartime runner in the resistance movement was the most exhausting and one of the most consistently dangerous,
observed Patrick Lee Firmer, who relied on them during his own tour of duty on Crete as a dirty trickster. So George somehow made it through not just one bloodbath, but two. First enduring 4 years of relentless manhunts, and then the vicious civil war that engulfed Greece immediately after the German occupation. Every decade since then, some fresh killer had swept across the island. Famine, drought, epidemic disease. Yet George survived them all, not to mention the constant Cretan peril of vendetta attacks. Even Patrick Lee Firmer, whose wartime derring do made him one of Crete's most beloved adopted sons, was startled to discover he'd barely escaped the crosshairs of a sniper rifle after a friend's nephew swore a blood oath of vengeance against him for an accidental death. For Chris White, the news of George's survival couldn't have come at a better time. Because the more he learned about George's life, Chris had discovered, the better he felt about his own. Chris lived in Oxford, and although the city, with its ancient university and cozy cottages, looked utterly tranquil, it attracted an unusual number of homeless. Chris worked with the unstable and depressed, and the despair he dealt with every day had begun to infect him. The backdrop of any Monday or end of holiday would be hearing that someone you'd been working with was dead, Chris says. I'd say hi to my secretary, and she'd say, hi, Chris, and then tell me about what we call incidents, someone kill themselves or try to kill one of your staff. Once, two staff members went to check on a guy in his home, and he picked up a knife and stabbed them both in the lower back. They survived, though. By the time